Welcome to Radio Sepharad's English Corner. I'm your host, Linda Jimenez, bringing news and other features of Jewish interest to Radio Sepharad's English-speaking audience in Spain and around the world. Our trivia question for this week is, what did people in the United States realize about sports for the first time in 1952? David Hirschberg is the pseudonym for an entrepreneur who prefers to keep his business activities separate from his writing endeavors. He's a New Yorker who holds an undergraduate degree from Dartmouth College and a master's degree from the University of Pennsylvania. His prize-winning first novel, My Mother's Son, is written as the memoir of Joel, a retired radio raconteur. The story is set in Boston in 1952 and revolves around Joel's extended Jewish family. Through their relationships with other characters, especially in the areas of business and politics, the author entertainingly conveys the multi-ethnic character of the city, portraying the Irish, Italian, and Jewish communities respectfully and without caricature. The novel uses the events of Joel's family's life and the world in which he lived as a child as a vehicle for dealing with major issues that affected Americans then as well as today: disease, war, politics, immigration, and business. Much like the narrator in My Mother's Son, Hirschberg is a skilled storyteller in real life as well as through his fiction. His interests outside of business are American history, Jewish literature and practices, the link between science and religion, the current cultural wars in our society, and English, Irish, and Gordon setters.
Thank you very much for speaking with us, David. Could you first tell us a little bit about your own background, where you're from, your educational background?
Sure. First, thank you for having me. I'm delighted to be here. I am a New Yorker. I have an undergraduate degree from Dartmouth College and a master's degree from the University of Pennsylvania. I started writing a few years ago, and I have to tell you that there are many ways you can be a writer. Some people, not me, seem to know as soon as they have pen in hand or touch finger to keyboard. But others, like me, came to writing later in life, much as I came to Judaism. When I was growing up, my knowledge of the religion was actually non-existent. I couldn't have told you the difference between the Torah and the Talmud. Mm-hmm. And the Exodus story for me, I like to tell people, was that of Paul Newman in the Otto Preminger film. So I had to catch up with my knowledge about Judaism, and I did this in lockstep with the world of words, Jewish words.
How did that come about?
So I'm an avid reader, and I've been participating in a variety of book groups with different foci, many of them Jewish, with a Jewish orientation. So I've read a lot of Philip Roth and Dara Horn and E.L. Doctorow and Toba Mirabis, Michael Chabon. Those are the kinds of writers I'm sure your audience knows well. And I got familiar with them. And I said to myself, you know, those people are terrific teachers. I don't have to go to a writing course and I don't have to get an MFA in something. They're showing me how to tell a story and how to develop characters and how to use the English language as more than a reporting mechanism. So I took all that and I said, I want to write a story about the major issues that affect Americans today and frankly affect people in all over the world today.
Was there something that happened that made you suddenly want to write at a later age?
Part of it was Act Two. I've done Act One, which is my basic business that I've been doing since in the early 1970s when I got out of graduate school. I had a wonderful career. I'm still doing a little bit of it, and I loved it. But what am I going to do for Act Two? I don't want to retire. And I said to myself, I don't play golf and I don't ski and I don't have a second house. And I've always wanted to write. And people have said that I write well. So I said, why not try this? And so that's what I did. It wasn't a one day waking up and saying, that's what I want to do. It was over a period of time. And I just became comfortable with the idea. And then, as you could well imagine, you write a first sentence, and that's either it, and you say, I know something is going to happen here, or not. And I wrote the first sentence, which was, when you're a kid, they don't always tell you the truth. And when, as soon as I put that down on paper, I knew I had something.
So this book is really the first writing endeavor?
It is.
Wow.
It's the first official writing endeavor. I've written things that were not published. Although now that I've written this, the interesting thing is the Jewish Book Council in New York asked me to write something. So I wrote a short piece called A Gift, and it's on the Book Council website. And I've written also about two-thirds of the way through a second novel. And I put the prologue in the first chapter on my website. And I have a lot of other projects in various stages of being formed. But yes, this is my first official writing.
Wow. I'm very impressed. I really am, because I really enjoyed the book. Let's start talking about the book. The book includes very detailed descriptions of Boston and the general ambience of what life was like in the early 50s. Is any of this from your own experience? Because you say you're from New York, you seem to know an awful lot about Boston. Did you do a lot of research for the book?
The answer is yes, I did an enormous amount of research, but not the typical research. And I'll tell you that we're really privileged today by the fact that we can access just about anything we want: historical events, times, culture, people. In the case of this book, news articles, photos, business people, immigrants, and stories and essays and pictures about things, in this particular case in Boston, the baseball team, what the trolley system was like, the racetracks, the buildings. You can also get on the internet blogs from soldiers who fought in Korea, the laws in Germany that preceded Kristallnacht, dictionary of foreign words, maps, lists of television shows, books, and music that can ground the novel in a particular period. All that's available. You have to go deep, and you have to know what you're looking for, and you have to be relentless in your pursuit. Because if you don't do that, it comes across as very superficial.
Why did you choose Boston to write about?
So this is really interesting, because in Boston, all of the elements that I wanted to talk about were there. There was a major polio epidemic, and I'm trying to relate everything in 1952 to today. So today there's AIDS and other serious infectious diseases. In 1952 in Boston, there was a major polio epidemic. Today, we have vicious political races in the United States. And in 1952, a young Irish congressman, later became president, was running for the Senate against an entrenched white Anglo-Saxon Protestant. And today we see as a matter of fact, just yesterday in primaries in the United States, we saw so many women and so many people of color and so many people whose parents or they themselves were immigrants are now entrenched in the political process. And the kinds of shenanigans and problems and issues that go on today were actually evident in Boston, in vote buying, and in all sorts of behind the scenes maneuvering with politicians and businessmen. And the sports world today, which I like to say there's more ink spilled on drugs and contracts and problems and arrests with athletes and teams, that when you go back in 1952, it was the first time a major sports franchise picked up and moved to another city. So while the baseball team picked up and moved to another city, and that was a shock to some local people in Boston, in fact, it was much more than that. It was the first time people in the United States realized that sports is a business. Prior to that, it was just a fun. You go to the game, everybody has a good time. They didn't realize it's a business the same way as selling cars or selling clothes or anything else. There's a team. It's got to make money. It has to generate more revenue than expenses. And if it doesn't do that, it has to change its business model. And what baseball teams do is they either build new stadiums, but in those days, they just packed up and moved to another city. So all of these things that were going on in Boston in 1952, plus the Korean War was going on, and that was a very different kind of war from World War II. In World War II in the States, everybody got involved. Even if you weren't in the armed forces yourself, you pitched in and did an enormous amount of work. Korea was a different kind of war. It was remote. There was no draft, so that there were very few people who would volunteer. And the problem in Korea was that most Americans didn't know about it and didn't care about it. And we have the analogy today where we have wars in Iraq, we have troops in Syria, we have troops in Afghanistan, and we have troops actually in North Africa. And we're all disconnected from that. So the analogy for all of these things happened to take place in Boston in 1952. I searched to try to find a city and a year. And after a little bit of analysis and deep dive, it became very apparent that this all came together in Boston. So that's why Boston, and that's why 1952.
We'll get back to that later, because I think that you draw some very interesting conclusions in the book, but another topic that I thought was very interesting were the Jewish topics. In other words, you wove 1930s Germany into the book very, very cleverly, I think, as well as the ideas of immigration and assimilation or not in the United States. And I also think that you treated the whole ethnic theme in the book in a very educational way. You talk about, you explain Jewish practices, Jewish food, Jewish languages, and then in the back you have a glossary which includes several languages, not only Jewish languages. And I think that that was very interesting.
So you've raised a lot of questions. I'll try to remember all of them, but if I don't, please just prompt me to answer those that I forget. But with regard to language, one of the things that was incredibly important to me is over the years when I've been in book clubs or just read books on my own, I've been very disappointed many times by the fact that different characters in the book use the same kind of language, they use the same kind of contractions, they use the same kind of colloquialisms, and it's very difficult to distinguish one person from another. And I said that when I write a book, I'm going to try to avoid that. I think it's a trap that a lot of people fall into because I don't think they actually have an ear for understanding. I shouldn't say all. Many people don't seem to have an ear for understanding how people actually speak. And the Irish, the Boston Irish in the early part of through the first half of the 20th century, they spoke with the kind of lilt and the kind of construction of sentences that the Irish speak in Ireland. And I'm sensitive to that. And so I used that. And throughout the book, you'll see that when an Irish person speaks, it's very different from when a Jewish or an Italian person speaks. And I did the same thing with Italians, and I tried to do the same thing with Jews. And then when I set several scenes in Germany, especially right after Kristallnacht in 1938, there are scenes in which the uncle of the narrator is leaving, trying to get out of Germany, and he has long conversations with a customs official. And that customs official is speaking, it's in English, I didn't write it in German, but is speaking as a German would speak in those days. And so it was important for me to do this, because then the book speaks to everybody in a different way. And then I used an enormous number of foreign words, and I created the glossary to make sure that when people were unsure of what was he really getting at here, what did he really mean by that, they could go to the back and find out. And one of my friends, who is a German national, lives here in the United States, I sent the book to him, and I sent him the glossary of German words. And so he called me up, and he said, of all these words, there's only one that I'm not so sure that you should use. And he said to me in German, he said, I didn't realize you speak German. And I said to him in English, I don't know a word of German, but I knew what you were asking. He said, well, how did you do this? And I said, well, that was part of my deep dive on the internet. And he said, but you only got one word wrong. And the one word was the German word for conundrum. And there are multiple words for conundrum. And I picked one, and he said, yeah, that's technically correct, but I've got another one, and I'd rather you use that one. And so I did this with people who were Irish, Italian, German, and many of my friends who have tremendous knowledge of Hebrew and Yiddish. And I sent them the book, and I sent them the glossary, and I said, just correct me. Just tell me where I forgot something wrong, either in spelling or in context. And it turns out it was only the German that came back with this one word. But that made me feel good that I had actually captured what people say and how they say it. With regard to your question on the Jewish, to me, I'm self-described as an observant reform, or in Europe, it would be observant progressive or observant liberal. So I go to Kabbalat Shabbat services every Friday night. I go to Torah study every Saturday morning. And I'm most other times, other times of the week, I'm at the synagogue once or twice. So I'm very involved as a Jewish writer. And I know that, for example, the late Philip Roth, he spent a lot of time denying that he was a Jewish writer. And he said he was an American writer, which of course he was. And yet all of his subjects were about, almost all of them were about Jews and the town that he grew up in. And yet he denied the fact that he was a Jewish writer. He has that privilege to do it, but I also have the privilege to say, I am a Jewish writer, and I like to write about Jews and about how Jews see the world and how other people see Jews. And to me, one of the most important and powerful parts of the book takes place near the end of the book. And I don't want to give too much away, but it's not really a secret. But it is a section in which the protagonist, now older in his 30s, has a discussion with his grandfather, who's in his 80s. And he asks his grandfather about all the shenanigans, all the illegal things, the bribery, the betting, the crimes that they committed as Jews, along with the Italians and Irish, but as Jews back in the early part of the 20th century. And he's trying to get from his grandfather some sort of an admission that maybe that was wrong or bad. And the grandfather very carefully and quietly responds to him with two words, two Hebrew words, tikkun olam. And the protagonist is astounded, and he says, repairing the world? How are you repairing the world by doing all of these terrible things? And the grandfather explains to him what it was like to be a Jew or an Italian or an Irish person in Boston up until the 1950s, and how they were second-class citizens. And what he basically said is, in order to repair the world, we had to tear it down. And we had to go about things in a different way, so that at some point in time, we would get the votes and we would be in power. And he said, so we repaired the world in a very different way. It's different from how we think of tikkun olam today, is feeding the poor and allowing healthcare to go to everybody. Those are terrific things, but this was a completely different take on it. And people today in the States don't realize, for the most part, how difficult it was to be an immigrant and how difficult it was to be a Jew 50 or 100 years ago. And this was my way of infusing this into the book, it's an important thing for me, and hopefully readers will find it important as well.
Well, it's always difficult to be an immigrant, I think.
I don't think there's any question about that, especially if language is an issue. I give tremendous credit to people. I don't know if you're aware of this, but in the States, 50% of medical school students are from foreign countries. And most of them, English is their second or third language. It is one of the most impressive things to me, not only to be an immigrant and do well here, but to be able to understand our culture, not having grown up in it and not having known our language as a young child. That's really impressive to me.
Yeah, this sort of leads us to what I wanted to get back to, which I told you before I wanted to get back to it. The book mostly takes place in Boston in 1952, but there are references to 1922 to 1938, especially what went on in Germany, to 1982 and to 2011. And the next to the last chapter, which you title The Prison That Refracted Our Societal Attitudes, Values, and Policies, you're comparing these different times. And it seems to show a kind of an evolution from an initial optimism to a kind of a general pessimism. And I just want to read you a quote from that and get you to comment on it. You say, "Our American culture has been profoundly changed, and one can arguably trace the center of this shift to the time immediately preceding and following 1952, allowing us to view this year as the prism that refracted our societal attitudes, values, and policies toward war, disease, politics, sports, business, and immigration." So can you tell us a little bit how this has evolved? I mean, you did speak a little bit about it, how important these things were at the time, but can you talk a little bit about how this has evolved and if you really feel that it has become more pessimistic?
I'm generally an optimistic person. And I think up until the election, the national elections of November of 2016, I was quite optimistic. But what's happened in the last year and a half has made me less optimistic as to what's happening to our society. Now, a cynic could say that nothing has changed. You know, the French say, plus ça change, plus c'est la même chose. The more things change, the more they stay the same. And that cynics here in the United States say, well, actually, nothing is different today than it was in 1865, which is when the Civil War ended. That we still have North versus South, we still have bigotry, all of the issues that existed that helped create the conflict in our Civil War, or the War between the States, as it's sometimes called, exist today. And I am not as optimistic as I used to be. And part of that it relates to technology, actually, that the good things about the technology allowing you and I to speak today over Skype when we're more than 3,000 miles apart is terrific. But it's that same use of electronic communications on a worldwide basis that allows you to look up how to create a nuclear bomb, how to put bombs in backpacks that are undetectable. Hatred can be spread quite easily. False narratives can go around. We've seen the Russian government tried to hack into databases and Facebook and create bots that said some pretty terrible things about candidates. So I'm not as optimistic as I used to be. And I think some of the naivete that we had at the end of World War II, which was, you know, war is going to be over. We're never going to have another world war. Many of the people in what were then colonial, they weren't countries yet, but they were about to be countries, were started the process of becoming free. Tremendous amount of optimism. And I think we've seen the data is in, and it's not great in terms of general health in the world. Wars haven't been eradicated. Now, there are some wonderful things that have happened, especially in the area of science and technology as relates to healthcare. Some amazing things have happened. And there are some good things throughout our society. But stepping back, I tried to find an era or the cusp of an era where you could see a change. And I think that we could argue whether it was 1952, and we could argue whether it was Boston. But I don't think there's much arguing that there has been a change. We can debate the extent of the change, whether this is just a blip, and that on the long, long term, 100 years from now, we'll be back on a different track. And I hope that's true. But I'm not sure about that. I mean, think about this. Writing a book that talks about Kristallnacht and all of the problems in the Holocaust. And up until a few years ago, anti-Semitism was practically, I don't want to say it was non-existent in the United States. It was there, but it was kind of under the carpet. And today, Jewish hate crimes are up by a tremendous percent. Attacks on Jews wearing kippahs in Europe is extraordinary. It never used to be that way. So it's remarkable that just 75 years later, we have a lot of the same problems becoming more prevalent. And so, yes, it does lead to a little bit of pessimism.
I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there. Thank you very, very much. This has really been very interesting.
I hate to leave anything on a pessimistic note because the book is actually quite upbeat. But
okay, well then, is there anything else that you would like to add quickly?
I'm proud of the fact that the book has been out for only 3 weeks and it's already won 2 awards, and so I'm buoyed by that, which gives me the confidence to continue writing and to get excited about the second novel.
Okay, well, thank you very much. We're looking forward to the second novel.
Thank you, Linda. I really appreciate the time and the care that you took, and I look forward to listening.
You can read David's short story, A Gift, by clicking on the link on this page. Well, that's it for this week. As always, we'd love to hear from you. So please email us any comments or suggestions or questions you'd like us to answer on the air. Our address is English Corner @RadioSephirod.com. See you next week.